Choice with Paige Nick on FMR.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. We'll be here with you in your radio, or maybe with you in your car while you do errands, maybe you're at work, and we're going to be chatting about books for the next whole hour. We've got a massive batch of fantastic book reviews, and we've got two phenomenal author interviews to keep you entertained and to give you lots of ideas of what to read next so that you can stack them up on your bedside table and get going reading them together with us. On today's show, we start off with Beverly Rose Miller. She's going to be reviewing Orbital, which was the winner of the Booker Prize in 2024. This is a very small novel that's actually exploded into this massive, huge book. I'm very excited to talk about it. We've also got Riley Herbert Henry joining us, and he's here to review a book called Saltwater Pool Boy, which is by Peter Adrian Altini. It's a South African novel. After that, we're joined by Twanji Kalula, and we're going to have a little bit of a Youth Month segment because it's Youth Month this month. So Twanji Kalula and Rachel van der Pfeffer are here for that, to show up for Youth Month. Twanji is going to be chatting about a book called The First Generation Founder by Raymond Ledwaba. And then, as I mentioned, our young adult reviewer, Rachel van der Pfeffer, is here, and she's going to be reviewing a young adult title called Mismatched, which is by Anne Camlin and illustrated by Isadora Zeffirino. After our Youth Month segment, we're going to go on to our regular nature book slot. John Hanks is here, and he's going to be telling us about a great-sounding coffee table book. It's called The Spirit of Africa. It's by Scott Ramsey. Looks beautiful. After that, we head into two massive interview sections to take us to the end of the show. The first is wonderful Beryl Eichenberger is here. She got to interview global superstar, best-selling author Kate Moss. And Kate Moss is also the founder of the Women's Prize for Fiction, which was announced on the 13th of June. They've just announced the winner. So she's been in the news a lot, and she was just in South Africa to promote her latest book. So we'll chat a little bit more about that closer to Beryl's interview at the end of the show. And then rounding up the show, Vanessa Levenstein joins us with possibly what I think is going to be one of the top five books this year for me. This is a South African title, and we love this book so much that Vanessa is going to first review the book to give you an idea of what it's about, and then she's going to interview one of the editors. The book that we're talking about is The Interpreters, South Africa's New Nonfiction, and it's edited by Sean Christie and Hedley Twidell. If you haven't heard about this title yet, you are missing out, people. You should have huge FOMO. This is one of the most important books to hit our shelves this year, in my opinion. We're going to tell you all about it, and we're going to tell you why it's such an important book and why it's such a brilliant book. How they pulled this off, I do not know. It's a massive amount of work, but it's paid off. It's worth its weight in gold, and this is a heavy book. And when I tell you some of the authors in the collection, you're not going to believe it. Anki Kroch is just one of them. Anyway, that's coming up at the end of the show, and that's our lineup for today's show. My name is Paige Nick. I am the host of Book Choice every couple of weeks. You tune into our wonderful show on Fine Music Radio. And our Book Choice show every month is sponsored by our wonderful friends at Exclusive Books. And all of these reviews and interviews I just mentioned are going to be bookended by some very fine music. This is, after all, always Fine Music Radio. And all the music on today's show has been selected and played for us by Mzumaketa. So I know that's a whole lot of information that I've just thrown at you, a massive lineup for a massive show and a whole lot of music. So let's start with a track, and then we're going to get right into it because we've got a lot to cover. Our first track on today's show is Does Anyone Really Know What Time It Is? And it's by Track 5.
Up to me.
That was Does Anyone Really Know What Time It Is by Track 5, and I know exactly what time it is. It's Book Choice time. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. Our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. And like I said, I know exactly what time it is. It's time for a whole lot of book reviews and a couple of author interviews that I think you're just going to love. We've got global authors. We've got local authors. We've got big hitting bestsellers and international and local prize winners. And we've got some titles that you may not have even heard of that might hopefully light up your cerebellum, get you excited and itching to read. First up, as I mentioned, we're joined by the wonderful and super smart Beverly Rose Miller. I was so pleased when Bev said that she wanted to review this next book because I loved it so much. And I wasn't the only one who loved it. This book actually went on and won the Booker Prize in 2024. It's called Orbital, you've probably heard of it, and it's by Samantha Harvey. It's the slimmest little book. It really is. I think it's maybe 138 pages or something, but it's such a massive mental read. And by that, I don't mean that it's hard to read. It is super accessible. It's very easy to read. But there is so much thought and so much intelligence and so many ideas packed into this little novella that I just spent half the time I was reading it being astonished by all the things that I was reading. And the other half of the time I was reading it, I was wondering how the author managed to pull this off and make it so believable. Obviously, the author hasn't gone to space. So to know so much about what it's like to be in space and what it's like to be on a journey like this and what it's like to look back on the planet just blew my mind. I don't know how the author did this, but she really pulled it off. Her research is impeccable. I love this book, Bev. I'm curious to hear what you thought of Orbital by Samantha Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Six astronauts have trained for years to cope with the challenges of living packed into a small metal capsule, looping around and around the Earth 16 times every day. This book, Orbital by Samantha Harvey, is the winner of last year's Booker Prize and is a joy to read, a short but intense hymn to our beautiful planet. She was formerly longlisted for the Booker, and this is her fifth novel and a very fine achievement. Almost nothing happens in the book, yet it is mesmerizing, always moving. We share their journey across the planet in light and dark, the quick days and nights just 90 minutes long, the edges of continents sliding past, the vast expanses of ocean, the deserts and mountains, and shorelines. What cannot be seen from the space capsule is people. Humans are too small to be visible. It is only at night that the clusters of brightly illuminated cities and towns indicate that people are living here, often in great numbers. But as the arc of the sunlight moves across these continents, we disappear once more. The astronauts loop more than once around the Cape Town at the tip of Africa's great mass, a turning point of ocean, then land, and ocean again, gliding quickly away to another vista. They observe with concern a great typhoon forming, signifying immense danger. The skies turn neon and glow and flow with color. Their eyes and hearts fill with sights they cannot fully explain. They will loop around and around this amazing planet for 9 months, each circuit following a slightly different trajectory, traveling at 17,500 miles an hour. Yet inside is a still motionless world of zero gravity and little drama, while the Earth, their mother, waits for her children to return. We couldn't survive a second without its grace. They grasp in a way that we who live in it seem unable or unwilling to do. Why are these six people here? This has given some thought, even as the next lunar mission races past them. They are living in a tin can in a vacuum, 4 inches of titanium away from death. We are a curious species. We climb into the death zone of Everest, plunge into deep ocean depths, fling ourselves up into the starry heavens, without an existential reward. In none of these places can we thrive. Our very curiosity is our survival genius, so probably we just can't help ourselves. Yet it might also be our downfall. The astronauts deal with private grief and loves. They feed and measure the experiments involving mice and plants. There are two Russian cosmonauts amongst the six space travelers, and the only place off limits are the two different toilets due to ongoing political disputes, says a pompous notice. Yet they are in fact living as one, where they share and reuse everything, breathing each other's recycled air. So the toilet prohibitions are, of course, just ignored. Point taken. As they watch, it is mid-morning coming into Russia, and in the shrill light, the Earth is once again a glass marble in blackest space. The whole globe has passed beneath and will keep on passing, and yet another day will break, and on they orbit. I love this book. It is exquisite. When I had finished reading it, I wanted to kiss it.
Oh, Bev, I felt the same way about that book. Once I had finished it, actually it was the same day as I finished it that evening, I popped out to buy a second copy because I really wanted one of my friends to read it urgently so I could talk to her about it. But I didn't want to give her my own copy. I wasn't willing to part with it yet. There were two facts in this book. I mean, there are thousands of facts in this book, but there were two specific facts in this book. The one is about terns, the Arctic tern, the bird, and the other one is about a photo taken in space. I can't tell you what these facts are because I don't want to spoil the book for you. I'll leave you to discover them and enjoy them if you decide to read the book. But I can tell you those two facts literally stopped me in my reading tracks. I couldn't believe what I read. I had to go back a couple of paragraphs, reread it. Then I called my partner and I read them out loud to him. It was so astonishing. So I think this is a showstopper of a book. I highly recommend it. I've read far more positive reviews than I have negative reviews of this book. And of course, the one, the Booker. So it comes highly recommended by many, not just me and not just Bev. Thank you so much, Bev, for that incredible review. Next up, we're joined by Riley Herbert-Henry, who's one of our new reviewers here on Book Choice, and he's going to be chatting about a book called Saltwater Pool Boy. Now, this is a very meaningful review coming up of a very meaningful book. I met the author, his name is Peter Adrian Altini, and I met him at the Kingsmead Book Festival in Johannesburg at the end of May. And he's such an interesting individual. There's something to me about meeting an author and talking to them and hearing them talk about their book that just makes you want to read their book. So Saltwater Pool Boy is right up there on my list of books to read. Riley Herbert-Henry, welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. Let's hear what you thought of Saltwater Pool Boy.
Grief and self-discovery are often paired together, but never quite like this. Saltwater Pool Boy by Peter Adrian Altini is a luscious, tender, and provocative exploration of meaning and identity that spans the youth and middle adulthood of our protagonist. The novel opens in Cape Town, where we meet Damon, who is caring for his terminally ill mother, who was diagnosed with a malicious form of cancer. To relieve himself of the stress of his day-to-day life, Damon goes swimming, and his world collides with the slightly younger and much more experienced Nico, who draws Damon out of his shell and shows him who he truly is. What follows is a sweeping tale of trial and error, stopping and starting over and over again, spanning locations from Cape Town to Rome and ending in Paris. This novel is a masterpiece of cultural exploration. Damon meets many people along the way, all crucial to his self-development. While some of these relationships might not have always been good for him, they were all necessary. Altini deals with themes of terminal illness and caregiving, assisted suicide and grief. He shows us what it means to find yourself in a world designed against you and to hold yourself accountable, not just to those around you, but to yourself. There is a scene where Damon is recounting his grief at losing his mother. He says, "She died and I live, and living feels wrong. I'm a ghost that feels nothing. I go through the motions, feeling nothing, until I feel everything, all at once, until I want to die all over again. Altini writes with a truth and compassion for his characters that we don't often come by. He allows them the exploration of their feelings without judgment or ridicule. On the sentence level, the prose is rich and vivid and lends itself easily to the style of the Italian operatic arias it references. One thing I will note is that having Google Translate at hand will prove useful, as we do not get any translation for any of the French or Italian phrases used. The language adds to the beauty of the ebb and flow that Damon feels. He's here, then there, then here again, his feet never touching the ground, never sure he truly knows what is happening around him. This book is essentially a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age novel. We see Damon through many stages of his life, through the cyclical and inevitable passage of time, through many romantic interests, and through the role he plays to the people close to him. He is a lover, a caregiver, a friend, a son, a brother, but at his core, he is simply himself. He never denies himself the pleasure of life, but at times finds himself undeserving of it. I truly believe that the less you know about this book going in, the better. It is a wild ride and will keep you gripped throughout. One of the true marks of a brilliant book is that it bears rereading. I think this quote from the text sums it up perfectly. This is where Tosca threw herself from the battlements. "You've told me this already," Damon said. Laughing, he said, "Some things are worth repeating." Saltwater Pool Boy is written by Peter Adrian Altini and published by Caravan Press.
Thank you so much to Riley Herbert Henry for joining us again on the show to tell us about Saltwater Pool Boy by Peter Adrian Altini. I had mentioned before the review that meeting the author at the Kingsmead Book Festival made me want to read his book. Such a nice guy and such an interesting guy. But I must say, Riley, that listening to your review has made me want to read Saltwater Pool Boy even more. So bring it on. Next up, we come to our nature segment. We're joined, as always, by John Hanks, and he's chatting about a book called Spirit of Africa. This is a big, beautiful, glossy coffee table book, and I think it's one you might want to own. John Hanks, tell us all about The Spirit of Africa.
Of all the books I have read, and the many I have reviewed, I have to say that I regard it as a privilege to present this review of an absolutely stunning production entitled Spirits of Africa by Scott Ramsey, which was published towards the end of 2024. In case you might think that saying it is a privilege to do this review is an exaggeration, I must justify my enthusiasm for this large book of 276 pages with over 150 exceptional photographs which have a genuine wow factor and some 30,000 words of carefully selected text. The publishers, Quivertree Publications and Rondebosch, have succeeded perfectly in reflecting Ramsey's commitment to protecting Africa's wildlife and wilderness areas. Anyone tempted to look at this further will almost certainly want to possess their very own copy. Scott Ramsey has a unique track record of experiencing and visiting over 100 of the continent's protected areas, and conservancies too, in 13 countries. And this book is the end product of 20 years spent photographing these areas and the species that live there, particularly lions and elephants. Almost every one of the photographs cannot fail to grab your attention and to admire Ramsey for the images he has captured so successfully. What particularly appeals to me is his recognition of the vital importance of connecting resident local communities with conservation initiatives, which he has done with photographs as well as in the text. He wrote, and I quote, "Spirit of Africa is a book about falling in love with the wonder of Africa's human spirit. It is a book about feeling truly alive and how wild Africa taught me to be effortlessly immersed in the present moment," end quote. You must read the words Ramsey has selected from some of the continent's most influential conservationists to appreciate how the Spirit of Africa stimulated him to become a great ambassador for the continent's extraordinary celebration of biodiversity. This total commitment over a period of 20 years is best summarized again in his own words, and I quote, "Through my work, I hope to inspire others to experience African wilderness for themselves, and then to stand up and speak for the continent's incredible wild places," end quote. The title again of Ramsey's book is Spirit of Africa, published in 2024 by Quivertree Publications, and at 1,200 rand per copy, I can assure you it is worth every cent. For each copy sold, Ramsay will donate 50 rand to the Endangered Wildlife Trust to support its conservation work in Africa, an additional commitment to be lauded. So please go out and get your own copy or order online through the publishers.
Was Blue Fountain by the Soweto String Quartet, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored, as always, by our friends at Exclusive Books. Right, we've got one segment under our belt, and now we come into our next segment, and I'm sure you already know this because we just had a public holiday the other day, but June is Youth Month, and so we thought we would do a whole segment. In fact, we've got two books here that focus on the youth and honors the fact that it's Youth Month. The first book that we want to chat about in our Youth Month segment is reviewed by Twangi Kalula. You know, so June being Youth Month and unemployment being the biggest challenge that faces our youth, faces all of us, we thought this book would make an excellent contribution to the show. Twangi is going to be chatting about a book called First Generation Founder. It's by entrepreneur and writer Raymond Ledwaba, and it manages some of the youth's biggest challenges, and of course it manages and talks about unemployment, entrepreneurial spirit. It sounds quite motivating to me and super interesting, and I'm hoping that it offers some solutions. Welcome to the show, Twangi Kalula. We're always so happy to have you here, and I'm interested to hear all about First Generation Founder by Raymond Ledwaba.
As we approach the end of Youth Month, I thought it would be a good idea to review something written by a young person about a problem affecting young people with solutions aimed at younger readers. So I picked up The First Generation Founder, How to Build a Startup Mindset and Thrive by Raymond Ledwaba. The title reminds me of one of my favorite proverbs about building wealth. The first generation creates the wealth, the second generation enjoys it, and the third generation destroys it. For all the triumphs of our dynamic democracy, we seem to have run through this cycle in just 3 decades. We desperately need a new batch of first-generation founders who can create wealth in South Africa. It is no secret that our unemployment rates are no longer sustainable. We have thousands of young, dynamic people sitting at home with no jobs and no obvious prospects. We see it in our crime stats, our poverty levels, and our social ills. Through no fault of their own, millions of young people are not contributing to the economy. They are not helping us solve our many problems, and they're not able to provide for the next generation. Entrepreneurship is certainly the answer to many of these woes. Like many young South Africans, Raymond Ludwaba grew up in a township towards the end of apartheid and the turn of democracy. He was lucky enough to have driven parents who worked their fingers to the bone to provide him with the opportunity to further his education. He went on to secure a bursary for his studies and became a chartered accountant, enjoying a stable career at some very prestigious companies. But, like many young people who are working, he was restless. After successfully founding a youth-focused sports NGO called Disky 99 with some friends in his spare time, the restlessness grew and he knew it was time to take on entrepreneurship full-time. He quit his 9-to-5 and joined his brother Jeff to run a successful IT business. He then started an African gaming business and is a partner in many other business ventures and initiatives. After a decade, he's acquired an MBA and over 60 employees to date. Ludwaba wrote this book for the potential entrepreneur. He doesn't want people with the potential to become high-impact entrepreneurs sitting in comfortable corporate jobs and getting by when they could be at the forefront of driving the change we so desperately need as a nation. This book is positioned as a call to courage. It is part memoir, part self-help, and part motivational guide. It is not too prescriptive, but it does offer an encouraging account that may be inspiring to anyone considering creating a business of their own. I really enjoyed how the author laid out a blueprint for developing a startup mindset, highlighting the tools one may need along the way, such as self-awareness, mentorship, courage, a solid network, and even luck. He also talks about tackling imposter syndrome along the way, which is something that he's honest about still facing today. Entrepreneurship is not for everyone. Many of us don't have a high risk tolerance, and I must admit the cynic in me did struggle with some of the innate enthusiasm and optimism that entrepreneurs have, which comes through in the book. That said, for those of us who can't picture doing our own thing or no longer qualify to be in any kind of youth league, there's still some gems that can be applied to our careers or a secret business idea that we have tucked away in the back of our heads. If you have a young person in your life who dreams of starting their own business or has just started in their professional career, I would definitely consider paying it forward and giving them a copy of this book. It is the kind of book that should be read by young people who leave you feeling like the world is going to be in great hands. If you're looking to be a catalyst of change or just need a nudge and want to be inspired by a dynamic young person's journey and perspective, it is definitely worth the read too. The First Generation Founder by Raymond Ludwaba was published by Tafelberg and retails for 330 Rand.
Thank you so much, Twangie. I really do hope deep in my heart that one of these dynamic entrepreneurs who reads this book and takes the advice and enters into the world, I really hope that they enter into the world of publishing and book selling in South Africa. I think the addition of some dynamic, exciting entrepreneurial spirit would make such a big difference to our industry. And I guess Twangie rightly points out, you know, unemployment is such a huge challenge, and entrepreneurship is possibly what has always saved South Africa in this regard. And hopefully it will continue to save us and bring great ideas to the forefront. Thank you so much for that, Twangie Kalula. And you made a really interesting insight that I wanted to mention, that if there's someone young in your life, one of these two titles that we're covering in this Youth Month segment might inspire them, might go on to change their life. We've got a memoir, and Rachel's going to join us next to talk about some fiction. And imagine if one of these books might just inspire them or get things moving for them. A book can make such a huge difference in somebody's life. So the next title that you might consider coming up is a novel. And Rachel van der Pfeiffer is here. She's our young adult reviewer. And she's joining us today to chat about a book called Mismatched by Anne Camlin. That sounds like a whole lot of fun. And it's been illustrated by Isadora Zeffirino. So we think this is a great addition to our Youth Month segment. Something a little bit fun, a little bit light and bright. Welcome to the show, Rachel van der Pfeiffer.
Mismatched is a modern graphic novel retelling of Jane Austen's Emma. Meet Evan. He's 17, he's a social media celebrity, and he's an excellent matchmaker. Or so he thinks. Everyone else, not so sure. When Orchid Natalia joins the school's GSA, Evan makes her his newest target. But after a series of failed matches, he's no closer to finding love for Natalia or himself. And he might just have ruined all his other friendships in the process. A lot of books these days are criticized for being much longer than needed. Mismatch has the opposite problem. I would have loved to read it, even if it was twice as long. It was a lot of fun, full of chaos, queerness, and an awesome ensemble of characters. Evan was quite unbearable at first, but by the end of the book, you'll be sure to find yourself rooting for him anyway. Unfortunately, also due to length, it felt rushed in parts, and a lot of the character storylines were wrapped up too quickly. Emma is a long novel with a lot of complex character dynamics, and there wasn't really enough time to unpack all of it. I think it would have worked better in a longer format, maybe as a series of books. I really loved the art style, and I enjoyed reading it slowly to appreciate all the fantastic graphics. I haven't read Emma myself, but I think if you have, you'll really enjoy figuring out which Emma character each character was inspired by, and spotting the other references that are dotted throughout the novel. Mismatched would also be perfect for fans of the Heartstopper graphic novels. Mismatched is written and illustrated by Anne Camlin and Isadora Zerafino, and published by Anderson Press. That was Meadowlands by Afro Tenors, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And our show, as always, we're so grateful, is sponsored by our lovely friends at Exclusive Books. Right, we're into the final kind of two segments of our show today, and these are both interview segments. The first one is super special. We have a global superstar best-selling international author on the show. Beryl Eichenberger joins us, and she got to interview Kate Moss, who is a best-selling British author. Her latest book is called Map of Bones. You may recognize her name because Kate Moss was just here in May to join us at the Franschhoek Literary Festival. She had packed out audiences. I was in Franschhoek and I saw long queues down the street outside all of her panels. People were racing to buy her books and racing to get them signed. It was very exciting to have her here. Another thing that's so exciting about Kate Moss is that she runs a very important literary prize. It's called the Women's Prize for Fiction, and it's a global literary awards ceremony, and the latest winner was actually just announced on the 13th of June. I want to tell you a little bit something about the Women's Prize for Fiction. It's a very prestigious award made annually, and this is its 30th year. As one of the most successful and popular literary prizes, the Women's Prize for Fiction champions and amplifies women's voices. So I had read three of the six books that were on the shortlist for this award, and I had a favorite, and that was The Safe Keep by Yael Van Vogden. And amazingly, The Safe Keep won the award, so I was really happy about that. I do think it's a very worthy winner. I'm very glad it won. And it's an astonishing book. I can highly recommend it. And it has a big spoiler, so I don't want to talk about it too much. There are lots of reviews on it on the Good Book Appreciation Society, which is the book club that I run on Facebook. So if you're looking for a review of the book that won the Women's Prize for Fiction, The Safe Keep, you can find it on the Good Book Appreciation Society. The reason we're talking about that is that Kate Moss was in the studio and she manages the whole awards. She runs the whole awards ceremony. But that's not the only hat she wears. As I mentioned, she's also a globally best-selling author. And right now she's promoting her book called Map of Bones. So Kate Moss has great roots in South Africa. In fact, this whole trilogy of books, The Map of Bones is the final in the trilogy, are set in the Franschhoek Valley right here in South Africa, and they were inspired by her first trip to Franschhoek Literary Festival, which is so exciting. I love that South Africa is such an inspiring country that it's even inspired globally recognized authors to write these massive best-selling series about it. And so we're over the moon to welcome to the studio Beryl Eichenberger chatting to Kate Moss about the Women's Prize for Fiction and also about her latest novel, Map of Bones.
2025 is a big year for award-winning British author Kate Moss. Apart from celebrating the 20th anniversary of her best-selling novel, Labyrinths, the Women's Prize for Fiction, which she helped to found, celebrates its 30th winner, and she was recently awarded the British Book Award for Social Impact. A trio of accomplishments for a best-selling author. Her books have sold millions. Her passion for women, legendary. But it is her quartet, the Joubert Chronicles, which has shone a light on our own history. Kate was here for the Franschhoek Literary Festival. We got to chat about that final book, Map of Bones, and of course where it all started. So, hi Kate, welcome into the studio.
Thank you, Beryl, thank you.
If I might just read that little portion of Map of Bones, which I think said so much about you and your focus and everything else. At the heart of the Map of Bones is a belief in the power of words, that unless women's stories and testimonies are included alongside those of men in the historical records, it cannot really be called history at all. That is such an indictment, virtually, on history, isn't it?
It is a bit. I mean, the first thing to say that's so, so important, it's never about taking men out of history. It's about putting women in where we always were,
mm-hmm.
because the living of history has been men and women, everybody together. But the writing of history has been in the hands of a very, very small number of people, almost exclusively men, because it came out as a discipline from universities and religious institutions where women were barred. And for that matter, a tiny, narrow band of men. So it's about putting everybody's story, whatever race they are, whatever faith they are,
exactly.
whatever they look like, back into the history books, because guess what? We built the world together. So that's what I'm about. It is about centering women's stories, but we were always there.
Yes. But now, where did this love of history start? Because your books are historical fiction and they take you back. You have some favourite centuries, don't you?
I do. this was one of the things about writing the Joubert Family Chronicles, that it's a story set against the Huguenot diaspora, 300 years of history from the beginning of the Wars of Religion in France in 1562 to 1862 in that graveyard in Franschhoek. And that's where the whole story started. But the thing about writing any kind of history is that there are some periods that appeal to you more.
Yes.
So I'm a medievalist, really. I like the fin de siècle, the 1890s, and that sort of tipping moment. But the period I've never liked is the 17th and the 18th century, and that
here
is the story.
Right,
here I
it.
Am. But the thing is, what happens with an idea for novels is that characters, a place, a bit of history comes and taps you on the shoulder. And with this series, the Joubert Family Chronicles, I resisted it for a long time. I kept saying, Kate, you don't know anything about the Huguenots. You don't know anything about the history of South Africa, except since the Second World War, and it's a bit of a minefield. You don't know anything about that part of the world. But everything for me starts with place. And if I had not come to the Franschhoek Book Festival in 2012, and I had not stood in that Huguenot graveyard and heard the song of those refugees, as it were, I wouldn't be here now. And so I never decide to write a period of history. It's standing there in that place and hearing the song of the land.
And then, yeah. literally tapped you on the shoulder.
Yeah, I mean...
She tapped you on the shoulder.
She did. Well, I mean, it was more that I kind of was witness to a crime, essentially. Because I was standing in that graveyard in Franschhoek, having not known anything about the Huguenot history, the French history in this part of the Cape. Fell in love with the landscape. But more than that, I thought, oh, this looks like the landscape of southwest France. And just imagine if you'd grown up hearing your mother, her grandmother, great-great-grandmother, going back all the way, 300 years, to the beginning of the Wars of Religion that sent you from your land was taken, and you'd never even seen it, but you'd heard about it. You know, the Greek word nostalgia actually means a longing for home.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means. So standing there, and I looked at the Franschhoek Mountains, and I thought they look like the mountains of southwest France. And at that moment, I thought, I can write a positive story about displacement, about finding yourself an exile in a strange land, but making it home. And then very clearly, I had an image of a woman in 19th century clothes leaning forward to rub the lichen from a gravestone to see who was buried there. And then it took me 13 years, not until the Map of Bones did I learn who she was. But it's taken
Good
me
heavens.
12 years of writing, yeah. I didn't know until I got there, and it was like, ah, oh, yeah.
And you had no idea when you went to Franschhoek of the French connection
None
there.
None at all. I mean, my lovely driver driving me in from Cape Town clearly thought I was a complete fool, because I said, oh, I had no idea there was any French history in this part of the Cape. And he said, well, don't you know that the name Franschhoek means the French corner? And I didn't. So, of course, this is not hidden history, but it was hidden history to me.
Yes.
And what has been very interesting, being back at the fantastic Franschhoek Book Festival for the third time in 2025, is I've met a lot of people who are local to Franschhoek, people who are in their 80s and 90s and have lived there for a long, long time, also saying, we were not taught the Huguenot history.
Right.
It was a line in our history books. Because that's the problem with the history, that one dominant group gets control of the narrative. And then they write about this tiny group. The rest of us, we don't exist. But again, we were there too. So that's been rather joyous. I thought everybody would go, yeah, we know this, Kate. But actually, readers have been going, we didn't know about this. We didn't know how the French language then disappeared within a, you know, a couple of generations. We didn't know that they were so fundamental in the wine industry and that that's why they were invited.
And all the wonderful wine farms that have French names.
French names, and that was
Chamonix, Lamotte.
Absolutely. La Rochelle, which is the great Huguenot capital. And that was when I first saw that. I thought, that's interesting, because La Rochelle is a very particular city on the west coast of France, but it was where the Huguenots made their base. So it was, all of this has been fantastic, but being out here and so many readers coming up to me and saying, oh, actually, I'm descended from the de Villiers family, I'm descended from the Joubert's. And of course, what's funny is that, of course, I'm a Francophile.
Yes.
So I'm saying all these names in the French way. And I come here and people are telling me their name and I'm going, what? And of course, they're now South African names.
Duplessis.
Dutoy. Dutoy. It was like, yes. That is very peculiar. But it's great because, of course, what that shows is that humanity is about the stories that men, women, everybody can tell. And that anybody who finds themselves in a place and makes a home belongs to it as well. You know, you can't have it both ways. It's got to be everybody belongs or nobody belongs.
Well, if that hasn't whetted your appetite to read The Map of Bones, which is the fourth in the quartet, The Joubert Chronicles, published by Pan Macmillan, I don't know what will. It is a magnificent book. It can be read standalone as well, but I think once you've read it, you'll want to go back in history. Kate, thank you so very much for coming in this morning, and wonderful to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Was Quando, Quando, Quando by Nossa Vida, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored, as always, by Exclusive Books. Right, I mentioned the next title up front, and I told you that it was one of my very favorite books so far this year, and it's called The Interpreters, South Africa's New Nonfiction. It's a selection of essays that have been edited by Sean Christie and Hedley Twiddle. This is an exceptional, exceptional book. It's just come out a couple of months ago. It's very thick, so one of those deep reads. I have to tell you, I haven't finished it. I've started it, but I'm taking as long as I can to read it. I really want to enjoy every single one. I do think this will be in the top five books that are brought out in South Africa this year. I highly recommend it. So much so, we're talking about bringing you this book on the show. We thought we'd do something slightly different. So first up, Vanessa Levenstein is going to review The Interpreters, South Africa's New Nonfiction. So she's going to tell us a little bit about the book, what's in it, what you can expect, what the whole idea behind it is. After that, she's going to follow it up with an actual interview with one of the editors of the book, Hedley Twiddle. So they're going to chat then in a little bit more depth about how they edited it, how they curated it, what made them think to do a book like this. It's very unique, how they pulled the whole thing together. So we're going to get a review first. And that's happening right now. Vanessa's here telling us about The Interpreters, South Africa's New Nonfiction, a book I cannot rave about enough.
The Interpreters, South Africa's New Nonfiction, edited by Sean Christie and Hedley Twiddle, gives credence to the expression, life is stranger than fiction. The stories are so riveting. In some cases, even poetic. It feels like fiction. This nearly 500-page anthology showcases three decades of post-apartheid writing from 33 exceptional journalists. Some names are better known than others, but a famous name doesn't guarantee it will be your favorite chapter. All contributions are good. There is no weakest link. This anthology deals with a lot of pain, struggle, and injustice, which is apt considering the subject material, South Africa. But there's also humor and in some cases hope and perhaps catharsis. But if you're looking for reassurance about our past and present, this collection isn't it. However, if you're looking for brilliant writing, stories that expand your world, work you may even identify with, testimonies that leave you wanting more. This book has it all, and it's deeply meaningful. We descend into the underworld with illegal miners, the Zamazamas. We dodge and get hit by bullets. We enter a fertility clinic, visit an art gallery, and, as to be expected, there's a lot to do with land, from farms to a posh suburb built over graveyards. I have to mention by name one of the stories, which is also the title of this anthology, The Interpreters. Here, we get under the skin of the TRC interpreters. Mind-blowing, actually. And then they've even included chapters from cartoonists. Each chapter I've underlined a quote worth sharing, so almost randomly I had to choose two. Listen to these words from Lynn Sampson's Now You've Gone and Killed Me. That's how it was told by the girl, with the shaking hands, and I can assure you, she is beyond imagining anything. In her life, imagination is superfluous. And this from Bongani Madonda's Amazrali and Fantasia. Remember, this is non-fiction. The visitation was followed by a dream in which, hold your breath, he grew feathers, flew into the sky, and finally came across a swarm of locusts, the size and ferocity of which he'd never seen. I could go on. I could go on. Or, better still, I could stop here and speak to one of the editors of this collection, Hedley Twidell.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. I think that's an excellent summary of what the book is really about. As I said, I haven't even finished it yet, and I can't recommend it enough to everybody that I'm talking about. This is that book that you're always telling everyone about. It's a book you can gift. It's a book you can keep forever. And I think they're going to be bringing it out a few of them. I think this should be something kind of regular, although you can see the amount of work it's taken to bring out this kind of excellent journalism. So I would imagine they would need a couple of years. It's such excellent writing. They would need a couple of years between bringing out each one. So to round off that brilliant review, we wanted to actually chat to one of the editors to find out a lot more detail about where the project came from, how they got to it, why they did it, and how they did it. As a small independent publisher, how they pulled this off is remarkable. They've embarked on this massive journey to pull together these incredible authors and these incredible essays. So Vanessa Levenstein is back now, and she's chatting to Hedley Twidell about the experience of creating The Interpreters.
Welcome to Book Choice.
Thanks very much, Vanessa. Great to be here.
I want to start off with, what is creative nonfiction?
Yeah, it's a difficult label because it's a sort of non-definition. And I would say it's both totally useless because on the one hand, the writing in this anthology can use all the techniques of novels or short fiction to make characters real, to set scenes, to play with voice and perspective. But on the other hand, you can't get rid of the term nonfiction because I think when we hear or read a story, one of the first decisions we make is it truth-directed or not? Is it trying to deal with the world as it is, or is it trying to deal with an imaginary world? So I suppose creative nonfiction or literary nonfiction is to signal that it's beyond just hard news reporting. It's beyond just fact-based writing. It's bringing in the techniques of literary narration and storytelling that are used by many other kinds of writing.
What was the criteria you used to find these stories? Because they were all previously published, is that correct? And were you looking for that particular narrative style?
Oh, that's a good question. No, there's a huge range in this collection. And, well, the criteria, there were a few of them. One of them was, did the writer take a risk? And there's many different kinds of risk you can take in writing. You can take a physical risk. I think of the piece on Zaman Zamas by Kimon de Grief that you mentioned. You can take a risk of personal disclosure, like Julie Nadi writing about discovering something as a child, or Anna Hartford writing about IVF, or you can take a risk of saying something, you know, politically difficult to hear. So risk was one. We also, maybe a bit of a more nebulous one, we looked for pieces that only, it seemed that only this writer could have written this piece. I mean, I'm thinking of Prof. Njabula Ndebele. He goes to a game lodge on holiday. He meets an American family there. One of them says, gee, now I know what it feels like to be a colonialist. And he thinks about the game lodge from this perspective. And, you know, to me, only Njabula Ndebele could have written that piece because he's both a storyteller and he's both an academic and a social theorist, and he brings those two together. I also think of William Dicey's extraordinary essay about being a pear farmer in the Boerland. I don't think there's any other pear farmer in the world who could have written about the difficulties of being a farmer and so honestly about land and labor relations and the impress of the past as William Dicey. It's a remarkably frank, fiercely honest piece, but also a gentle piece. It's kind of gently anguished as well, as I say in the intro.
There's an honesty, a vulnerability, and a truth that threads through all of them.
Absolutely. The paradox, though, is that there's a wonderful bit from Anki Kroch's Country of My Skull, the famous book about the TRC. She's reporting as a radio journalist, and an engineer says, "Hey, when you say the word truth, your voice tightens up, and you know, you must relax." And he says, "Truth is most your job." And she says, "I'm very suspicious of the word truth." And the paradox is that actually it's often by being suspicious of overbearing truths with a capital T, i.e. truths that are too general, that are too easy, that are too quick, that you get the will to truth, the truth directedness that you feel in this kind of writing, which is suspicious of truths with a capital T that are arrived at too easily.
Okay, so I'm so tempted to start unraveling her chapter, The Interpreters, but I can't, because every single time you touch on something, I actually want like another 10 minutes to talk about, but our sound engineer, Mazu, is looking at me and shaking his head. So we're going to have to plow on. I want to talk about the reason why you did this collection. Was it at all influenced by the fact that a lot of our really good publications are closed?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions. You know, putting together a book like this, it takes you into a history of where pieces like this have appeared. And that ranges from, Freya Wiekblad, Mail and Guardian, Chimurenga, it's an amazing Pan-African Gazette founded by Antonia Jabe. It's a range. Some pieces appeared in the New Yorker or Granta, some of the most prestigious venues in the English-speaking world. Some appeared in little journals called Proofrock or Mampur that only lasted for a few years. Some appeared on Rustam Kozain's essay Dacha about growing up outside Paul. He published it on a blog, and then it got collected and recollected. So yeah, it is one of the worries that, you know, there's not, platforms are closing down. I don't know, the Mail and Guardian are, you know, halving their staff. Things are being handed out to AI. But I still think there's still always an appetite for long form writing where someone, a real person, really thinks about something hard.
AI is a whole different discussion, and people can say what they want. AI could not have produced this book.
No.
Not in a million AI years. You used the word risk earlier when you were talking about the risks the writers took. And I also thought it was quite brave decisions you made. I didn't read any preppy Pollyanna-ish stories. And the last chapter,
I gave the names by Adrian Liftwich.
Yeah. Quite a brave chapter to end off with.
Absolutely. Yeah, he sold out his comrades in the struggle, and he turned state evidence. He was a disgraced figure. And then years later, he reflects on what he did as a young man, and it's this reckoning with something shameful that he did. I think it's also got a lot to say about how all of us have to work through what's shameful in our past and what's difficult and what's awkward. I mean, I lived through the moment of the student process, and a lot of what young students were saying was, we haven't reconciled everything, we haven't sewn everything up. You know, there's a lot of things that are still to be discussed and resolved, or, you know, they will remain unresolved. So for me, the kind of writing that is important is writing that doesn't rush to tie things up. You know, if you're writing a piece, by the end, you can feel an urge to tidy things up and tie it up in a bow. But for me and for my co-editor, the kind of writing that provides real consolation, it's not so much about a resolution, it's maybe about a consolation, about seeing someone else think about something, live with something, live through something. It provides, I would say, nourishment. It provides something for the soul, if I can put it that way. Meaning, rather than that rush to a quick conclusion, which can seem false or forced or rushed.
Exactly. And that doesn't lead to one feeling happy because it's empty.
Indeed.
So this was very, very meaningful and cathartic in ways.
We did try to keep a few funny pieces in there. Originally, we were going to put some of our own pieces in, and I really regret not putting my co-editor's piece, Searching for the Soul of the Yuxke River, in, which is a hilarious piece in which he follows the Yuxke River. But we do have Michael Haynes talking about, you know, cruising the public conveniences of Central Cape Town as a young gay man. Incredible piece. Rian Malan's piece on Solomon Linda's song Mbube, which becomes Wimmerware, which becomes In the Jungle. It's a tour de force. It's incredibly amusing, even though it's about painful material in some ways. So, you know, the tonally, even though the subjects can be difficult, I mean, I think of Mohorosi Mochumi's graphic autobiography, Hard Rock. He's dealing with all kinds of things, detention, disability, HIV/AIDS stigma. But he does it in such a madcap, zany way, a wry way, and he's doing it through cartooning. It's very intriguing to see these weighty subjects being taken on by someone with a real eye for the absurd like that. So the graphic nonfiction, which my co-editor insisted on, was also a fascinating discovery for me.
So interesting. And you're reading the book, and then you come across this. Okay, one last thing. You mentioned a work that you really said didn't get into this anthology. So it means one thing. When can we look forward to The Interpreters Volume 2?
We've always looked at this as a two-volume project. We did this the independent publisher way. We are the basically the publishers. So as long as we break even, we want to do a second volume. And whereas this volume pulled more towards journalism, the second volume will probably pull more towards the essay and memoir. And we want to go further back in time. We want to go across the whole 20th century. And we want to get a much wider range and miscellany of South Africans writing, not just about South Africa, of writing about all sorts of things. This first anthology is really, it is about the political transition in many ways. But, you know, there's people writing about all sorts of things as well. So we hope for a wider, more, maybe more amusing, more essay-like sequel. So listeners, please go and buy it so we can do that.
Buy it because it's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Vanessa.
Thank you so much, Vanessa Levenstein, for that incredible segment. First, you did a review of the book. You read it so deeply, as you always do, and with so much empathy and so much understanding. You and I really do often enjoy a lot of similar stuff. So I was over the moon that you enjoyed it as much as I did, although I'm not surprised. And then you joined us after that with Hedley Twidell to dig a little bit deeper into the process of publishing this book. I love this whole conversation. I'm so glad we've covered this the way we have. Listener, this is a book. I urge you, go out to your local exclusive books and pick up a copy as fast as you can. And that brings us to the end of our show. All that remains is for me to tell you that Mzu will very kindly download the show as a podcast on finemusicradio.co.za as soon as the show is done. And I also want to thank Mzu Makeda again for being so generous with his time and helping us compile the show, curate all the fantastic music that goes into the show. Mzu, you're an absolute gem. I also need to thank all of our reviewers. You do such a wonderful job. It's not easy, but then again, we are talking about our favorite subject books, so at least there's that. I want to thank all the authors and the Fine Music Radio team for letting us have a whole hour long to chat about books. And of course, last but not least, I have to thank Exclusive Books, our sponsors, without whom there would be no show. And you, our dear listener, thank you for your time, thank you for your ears, thank you for your hearts. And I hope there was a book somewhere in the show that made you instantly want to run to your local Exclusive Books and grab it. We'll be back on air in 2 weeks' time. And until then, we're playing out with Downtown by Louise Howlett and Albert Combrink. And until we chat again, happy reading.
Is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown, things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown, everything's waiting for you. Downtown, don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where you never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of the gentle passing over. You'll be dancing with them soon before the night is over. Happy again. The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. Find a place for sure. Downtown, everything's waiting for you. Help and understand you. Someone who is just like you, who needs a gentle hand to guide you along. So maybe I'll see you there. We can forget all our troubles.